Welcome back to another episode of Benzinga Cannabis Insider. My name is Patricio Diddle. In case you don't know me, I'm a Benzinga Cannabis staff writer, and I'm going to be your host today as we dive into the financial and policy aspects of this rapidly evolving sector. As you may know, we are in the midst of the Q3 earnings season, and I'm thrilled to introduce our special guests today, Sandy Seyfried, Chief Executive Officer, and Jim Dennedy, Chief Financial Officer of Safe Harbor Financial, a company that had an outstanding performance in Q3. And Sandy is a visionary leader with over 3 decades of experience in the credit industry. And under her guidance, Safe Harbor Financial has become a trailblazer in providing compliant banking and financial services to the U.S. cannabis industry. So, Sandy, Jim, welcome to Cannabis Insider. Very happy to have you here. All right. Well, to kick off with the first questions, and again, highlighting the great quarter you had, Safe Harbor Financial reported a significant 82.1 increase in revenue in Q3 2023. So what strategies were key to achieving this remarkable growth?
Well, Jim, I'll let you go ahead and take that since you said it yesterday.
the key strategies we've always just focused on acquiring more accounts, acquiring more deposit activity from those accounts. So the business activity of the accounts we acquired, the relationships of the clients. If their business volume grows, there's more deposit activity. The compliance work we do around that deposit activity drives higher deposit activity and onboarding fees. The other strategy on which we focus is to recruit higher deposit balances by our clients so that they maintain their balances with us versus spreading it around to other financial institutions. We've opened up more banking products in the last 6 to 9 months that have attracted more of those deposit balances to Safe Harbor and our network of financial institutions. And I think the third piece would be we have become a lot more active in placing credit issuance to our clients. So those three initiatives have really been the drivers behind the year-over-year performance and revenue. And I would say the one thing that's inorganic is that we restructured a transaction with Abaca last year, in which we acquired a little over 250 additional new client relationships. And we continue to pursue that exogenous growth strategy as well, where we want to acquire additional accounts from other financial institutions who may have not reached the critical mass we have, where doing this compliance work is efficient for them.
And let me ask you regarding this competitive approach on the numbers we just talked about. What do you think that makes you different from other financial institutions that make the market players choose you instead of others?
Well, I think that's a great. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Sonny. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'll take that one. And in terms of what we do and why it's of benefit to those financial institutions is because, you know, cannabis is such a specialized market. And all we do is specialize in cannabis businesses and expertise in the cannabis industry and how to serve them on a financial level, which is if you try to mix that into your normal portfolio at a financial institution, it takes a lot of resources. So we eliminate the need for financial institutions to build up their own resources and utilize us. We also have a national platform because we're a fintech platform and we've been doing this across the country, and we actually take finances and funds from over 40 states across the country, we've already set up a remote system, a fintech platform that allows us to serve anywhere from California to Hawaii to even Puerto Rico. So that way we can address the entire cannabis market. We're not just limited to like a regional area or a community area or even a national type charter that is limited by wherever the branches are.
Oh, sorry, I was muted. I was going to ask you, Jim, if there's any other thing you wanted to add to this.
The only thing I would add from an economics perspective is that over the years, Sundy and the team have codified our specialized knowledge of this industry into proprietary software. And even if we get fee compression by competitors who think they may want to bank this space, we believe that we will still be the low cost competitor in the space because our IP allows us to leverage more accounts, more transaction volume, more deposits over our cadre of bankers to do that work. And I think that's going to continue to allow us to enjoy sustainable competitive advantages for the foreseeable future.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to go back to the earnings figures in a moment, but now that we are talking fintech, I want to ask, where do you see the future of financial services for the cannabis industry heading, especially in terms of technology and regulatory compliance?
Well, I don't see a great deal of change because the cannabis industry is actually so specialized, and because it's a high risk market, it's very similar to what you would look at in terms of money service businesses. That would include things like cannabis or casinos and check cashing facilities and grocery stores, any place where it's cash intensive. And cannabis will remain that way no matter what happens in terms of legislation or descheduling, and that makes it a high risk market. The other factor there is that there's such an active illicit or black market still trying to do business right in the middle of the legalized market, which makes it, again, even a higher risk market because financial institutions and service providers have to weed out those illicit activities, which makes it a very high risk market. Most financial institutions don't want to deal with high risk markets of that nature. So I see that it's always going to be dealt with in the same way, even if you look at the way alcohol is treated. And it has been legal for how many decades at this point in time, but it's still a difficult entity to bank in the financial system because it's considered high risk. So I think you're going to see cannabis treated very much like the alcohol market in the long term. And as far as fintech is concerned, that really applies to the whole BSA factor, bank secrecy. And the fintech allows us to manage that BSA obligation that is required by federal agencies to reduce the risk in the financial system. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. And fintech, again, allows us to specialize across the country. If you were to take a large bank that has, you know, 1,000 branches across the country, and they started serving the cannabis business and taking that cash intensive business by branch in 1,000 different branches, the ability to manage the risk on that cash coming into the financial system becomes spread out across the country and very difficult to manage centrally the way we do it. And that's the risk to the bank. And there are fines associated with not fulfilling those BSA activities to the standard that the federal agencies require. So I see us as a long-term player in this and leader and continued in the fintech platform to reduce the risk to the financial system.
Perfect. Very clear. Thank you. And again, going back to the numbers now, to the earnings report, Safe Harbor Financial has processed an incredible, over $1 billion in cannabis-related funds in each quarter of 2023. So how do you see this level of financial processing impacting the broader cannabis industry?
Well, I'll jump in here again, because the reason, you know, we watch those funds going in, quite frankly, we have actually processed over $20 billion in cannabis-related funds since our inception in 2015. And why is that important? Number one, our fees are based upon deposit activity by each client. So if you're a low-level client, you might be paying on the lower end $300, $400 a month. If you're on the higher end where you're processing millions and millions of dollars, you're up on, you know, maybe a couple thousand dollars in terms of fees you have to pay to us in order to get the compliance done. So it matters in terms of depository activity for us. But the real reason is we are a proven entity. The system allows us to continue to put billions of dollars into the system. We'll cross $4 billion this year alone. And that's a big chunk of money in the cannabis sector, but it's also proven. And the reason it's proven is because we have gone through 16 state and federal examinations, proven to the financial regulators across the country that we have substantial BSA obligation fulfillment and that we're able to keep the system safe. It doesn't mean illicit money doesn't find its way into the system. It means that we know how to prevent it to the best extent we can and find it and work with law enforcement when we do find issues that need to be addressed. It legitimizes, when you think about it, it legitimizes the cannabis industry. And they want that legitimacy. They want us to remove those illicit players. So in the long run, it's going to be that banking aspect that really starts to help law enforcement remove those illicit activities and assist legitimate businesses.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think it's a very interesting concept, the one you introduced about keeping the financial system safe. And maybe to go a little deeper into that subject, and considering your extensive background in credit unions and cannabis banking, how do you strategically navigate this complex regulatory environment, and particularly with the differing federal and state stances of cannabis?
That's a really good point. Because when we started in 2015, actually started doing the homework in 2014, all we had was the FinCEN guidance. But because we were in the banking world, we also had BSA knowledge. We understood bank secrecy. So it was a matter of figuring out how to apply bank secrecy regulations to the cannabis industry. And the difficult factor was the cannabis industry was under the radar. Nobody was standing up because of federal illegality and saying, I'm a cannabis company. Here's everything about my business. What happened was we had to go under the radar with them, learn their business, and then mitigate the risks. So it was really about making up the standard. And we did create the standard across the country in terms of how to manage cannabis funds safely into the system. So it really was a creative mode that we had to go into.
Exactly. Yeah, I can imagine. True pioneering work. And again, going back to the numbers, despite the revenue growth, the company also experienced a substantial rise in operating expenses and net loss. So could you elaborate on the primary factors contributing to these increased costs, and how do you plan to address them?
Sure. I think when you look at the business over the last three quarters and you segment out, as we've tried in our financials, some of the extraordinary expenses we've experienced. So, for instance, there were some fairly complex financial instruments put in place at the time of the de-SPAC that when I came into the business a little more than a year ago, I was like, wow, this has a really complex balance sheet for such a small company. But when you think about the de-SPAC process, that is not unusual for many companies that go through a de-SPAC process. And one of the things that many of the companies who have gone through a de-SPAC process depend is a PIPE or capital raise coincidental with the de-SPAC. The reason they do that is because most of those companies were loss-making. We aren't. We are generating positive operating cash flow and have been generating positive operating cash flow. What you see in our GAAP losses, our GAAP net income or GAAP net losses, have been write-downs of financial instruments, where based on the equity market value of our stock, there are reset or trigger prices that are tripped within those complex financial instruments that will devalue a receivable or will cause additional shares to be issued to pipe holders. And those things have to be expensed through the P&L. The other thing that occurred in the second quarter of this year was that when, as we indicated, we were going to demise the relationship with one of our financial institution partners, it accelerated a review of the goodwill we had booked in conjunction with the acquisition of Abaca. Upon that review, and due to the potential loss of accounts, we had to take an accounting charge in the second quarter. And when you strip out all of that, what we'd like for investors to see and what we've tried to highlight in various press releases is that our actual operating expense from the fourth quarter of 22 through our most recently reported quarter, we've taken almost $1 million of run rate expense out of the business over the last 12 months. Sundy and the team have put together some really strong initiatives to drive out extraordinary expenses or unnecessary expenses and increase our focus on efficiencies. And I think you'll see that in our coming quarters.
Thank you very much. And with a 123 year-over-year increase in the credit portfolio, what are the primary areas where these funds are being allocated within the cannabis sector?
We really like to focus on, we're still a startup in terms of credit. We haven't been issuing credit except for maybe a couple years. And that's a slow startup, slow ramp up, make sure everybody's comfortable, including our financial institutions. So it took us a while to do that. But we really like to focus on real estate senior secured loans. And that's the way we want to build the portfolio at this point in time. There are substantial number of opportunities out there where cannabis clients have had to purchase their buildings outright. And now they want to take cash out of those buildings and actually expand their business utilizing normalized credit. So that's really where we like to start the relationship, but it's not where we necessarily end it. If we know the customers, which is what we know best, we've been banking some of these customers since 2015. So we know their cash flow every month. We know their businesses every month. We can underwrite a loan with a lot of information already. And that's why that depository relationship alongside a credit relationship is very important. Once we get to know the customer and we extend credit with a strong real estate base, we will also consider other things like lines of credit, or equipment loans, or even some licensing values when it's considered a licensed state where there's only limited licensing. So we really look at each of those states as very different, and each of those credit opportunities are very different depending upon how long they've been in business. I will tell you the most difficult loan to get, and I don't think this would surprise even a normal business out there, would be in the startup area. Where projections are necessary to prove the business. And really, a lot of the cannabis industry is used to providing projections because they're used to providing it to investors. But now they're providing it to an entity that likes to write like a bank. So our loans are written like a bank, but you also get the benefit of a lower rate like a banking system versus an investor who's expecting a higher return.
Very interesting. And one last question. I loved hearing your insights and learned a lot. And I have one last question maybe to think about the future. What key changes or reforms in the cannabis banking policy do you foresee or do you advocate for in the near future?
I think that SAFER is a great start. We've had SAFE banking up 7 times and SAFE banking down 7 times, and now we've got SAFER up there, and I think it's a great start to legitimizing the market again and telling banks and financial service providers it's okay to work with this industry. They are now legitimate. I think the next step in terms of rescheduling or descheduling, I think will add some more complexity because rescheduling down to a 3 is really great for the industry because it takes away the 280E obligation, increases profitability, increases opportunity to grow. So that's great for the industry. But what happens when you get to a full deschedule and it becomes federally legal across the country? Now we're going to deal with what I foresee as the next problem, which is how do you deal state by state when you have a federal legal product at this point in time? Do you allow them to start moving their product across the country? Does California and Colorado really want product to go between each other because some states have excess product issues and other states have a really solid system? So I think that's probably going to be the next challenge, I should say, that we're going to face as we move further toward legalization, which I still think is a ways down the road. But I think the incremental change that they're making at this point with SAFER and considering rescheduling, I think are great for the industry.
Sandy, Jim, I loved speaking with you. Is there any other highlight, any other remark you want to add before we close?
No, I think that we're pretty excited about where we're going as a company and what we're doing. And 2023 was certainly a challenge for us after de-SPAC, but we feel like we are getting a really good handle, like Jim said, on the expenses. And we're going to be able to provide even better guidance to our investors in the longer term. And we look forward to being able to do that for the investment community.
Thank you very much. I wish you the best of luck. And we had another great episode here of Benzinga Cannabis Insider with Sandy Seyfried, Chief Executive Officer, and Jim Dianady, Chief Financial Officer of Safe Harbor Financial. Thank you very much, both. And I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Good to be here.